Okay, so, 7th grade, lunchtime, and I've got a tummy ache. It hurts so bad. I need some pink liquid or something. I can barely move, and because there's no adults around, I push open the door to the teacher's lounge, and I see Miss Martin sitting on Mr. Kudrow's lap, snuggling all close, both of them sharing the last drag of a cigarette. They look over at me. She jumps up with a quick cigarette stumped in the carpet, blouse straightened up, buttons checked. Uh-oh. I close the door. Figure my stomach maybe doesn't hurt as bad as I thought it did. Try to hurry away, but they rush out. Want to talk all up in my face. How are things? How's that project coming? How's your brother? By the by, you should know that sometimes people see things that look one way when there's another perfectly good explanation, and it's very bad to spread rumors. And I agree with everything they're saying, but certain things you just can't unsee. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, Behind the Curtain. Behind the Curtain. Amazing stories from real people who, for one reason or another, stumble across a backstage pass. My name is Glenn Washington, and I promise there is nothing to see back here because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to kick things off with a behind-the-scenes tour like you've never heard of. Snap Judgment's Joe Rosenberg spoke to Michael Idov, a journalist with his eye on the Russian film world, when he happened across the lead that he just had to follow. Snap Judgment.
Michael first heard the rumors back in 2008. Somewhere on the outskirts of the Ukrainian city of Kharkov, there was a film shoot, a big one, on which something very strange was happening.
I saw some commotion around it on Russian film blogs. Fired BAs and employees writing about how totalitarian and psychologically oppressive the set was, coming back with basically PTSD.
But then there was the other half of the crew, the ones who stayed.
People who got so involved with the film's production that they moved their families there and never left.
The film, a period piece about a mid-20th century Soviet scientist, was known simply as Dow. Its director, Ilya Zhirinovsky, had only one previous title to his credit. But now, supplied with a seemingly endless amount of money from various investors, and 4 years into the production with no end in sight, Zhirinovsky had supposedly gone mad with power, insisting that his cast and crew live full-time on an increasingly large and elaborate set, cut off from the outside world.
An acquaintance of mine compared it to something out of Heart of Darkness, half-joking that he expected heads on spikes around the encampment. Obviously, I was immediately interested.
Michael was dead set on finding out just what exactly was going on. So he pitched his investigation as an article to GQ, booked a flight to Kharkov, and after a little bit of journalistic maneuvering, managed to score 3 days on set with Zhirinovsky himself.
I remember pulling up to the set and thinking it wasn't all that imposing or huge, looking at it from the outside, because all you see is, cardboard and 2x4s.
That's when Zhirinovsky appeared. Wearing strangely outdated clothing and spectacles, the director looked sort of like a young Albert Einstein. He would be giving Michael a personal tour of the set. But first, Michael would have to be processed.
Because you were not supposed to admit that the film shoot was, in fact, a film shoot. Instead, everyone was operating under the notion that it's the 50s. That day, it was 1952. So I needed to be made into a 1952 version of myself. They took away my clothes. They gave me a new haircut with, like, temples shaved off. And gave me an incredibly itchy period suit, including the underwear. The one thing I was allowed to keep was my watch. I had a vintage watch from 1959, and after a pretty intense discussion, they decided it was okay to let me keep this watch from the future.
Then Zhirinovsky instructed Michael to give his freshly minted Soviet passport to a man guarding an otherwise nondescript hallway.
So you go through this very narrow, birth canal of a passageway, and then a small door opens, and you just kind of tumble out onto the set itself.
There, right in front of Michael, is a small Soviet city. And by city, I don't mean a movie set that looks like a city. I mean a city, straight out of 1952. There's a main square with monuments, apartments, a stadium.
A working cafeteria, a working barbershop.
And then, of course, there were the citizens.
It was 1 a.m., and even at 1 a.m., it was huge and it was populated. There were janitors in Soviet dress sweeping the streets. There were militiamen in Soviet uniforms patrolling the perimeter, just sort of, imbuing it with some sort of crazy authenticity. And you might ask, when was he directing? And the answer is he wasn't. That whole month, the cameras weren't rolling.
In other words, most of these actors weren't actually actors at all. Or if they were, they weren't acting anymore. The janitors, the barbers, those were their real jobs now. They worked and even lived on the set, whether Zhirinovsky was shooting or not. As if to prove it, he would take Michael into structures which Michael thought were just facades, but which proved to be fully functional apartment buildings, complete with 1950s refrigerators, stocked with 1950s food, stamped with 1950s expiration dates.
The detailing was truly insane. He kept insisting on flushing toilets in each building to show me, first of all, that they were flushable, but also to point out that they made custom width pipes for the toilets because the modern pipes made the wrong sound. They get hit the wrong note as the water descended into the bowl. Zhirinovsky himself at that point seemed just sort of beside himself with glee, showing me this enormous toy he had built and was now living in.
But Michael quickly realized that what got Zhirinovsky really excited wasn't the authenticity of the set, but what the set was doing to the people living there.
There was no traditional movie equipment inside. Instead, there were hidden cameras everywhere. You could film through holes in walls, you could film through holes in ceilings. There were hidden microphones and lighting fixtures like there would actually be in the Stalin-era Russia. Their function was to create a working totalitarian surveillance society. Those policemen on the set were real prison guards, and one of their functions was to listen in on conversations and fine actors sizable fines that they actually took out of salaries for using modern conveniences or for uttering modern words. As befits Stalin's Russia, everyone, including the cafeteria workers and the barbershop workers, moonlighted as a snitch. So, if you used modern words, within minutes, the guards would arrive and fine you for this. This happened to me several times. And then you looked around the room trying to figure out who the snitch was. And the answer is, as usual, everyone. The goal was clearly to create an absurd world with absurd rules, but then actually force people to follow these rules and see how fast these rules become normal. And this is something I've experienced myself. I am a Soviet child, and it's amazing how easily we accept these totalitarian society.
Or, like in any totalitarian system, not just accept it, but come to embrace it.
One of the seemingly endless female associate producers that Zhirinovsky had on set started out much like myself. She came on the set to interview Zhirinovsky and was so enthralled by the production that she never left. And I believe she left her husband.
So Michael knew that just because he was a journalist who could return to the comfort of his hotel room in Kharkov each night, that didn't make him immune to the pull of the set and the pressure to just kind of obey. Still, he was surprised at how hard it was to resist.
Because I wasn't on the set alone. I was there with Sergei Maximishin, a famous Russian photographer. And he was exactly the kind of person that Zhirinovsky could not abide. He just basically thought the whole thing was a joke and kept kind of cracking wise about it. He, kept using forbidden words like shoot and scene and lighting and makeup. And what's interesting is that I realized that his infractions made Mick cringe. Every time he would say something like, you know, shoot or lighting, I would be like, ah, God, no, shh. You know, they're going to find you.
Michael knew, of course, that this is exactly what Chernofsky wanted. For Michael to almost instinctively care about these obviously arbitrary rules, over and above any journalistic solidarity with his photographer. But it turns out that this conditioning was just one small part of Michael's larger indoctrination.
I got really good at putting on my period suit with the suspenders and the cufflinks and all that, and I had sweated so much into the suit it was pretty much mine. I had this sort of leisurely stroll on the set, already knowing where everything was, and I just started talking to this very beautiful girl who worked at the cafeteria. Her name was Olya, and at least her character's name was Olya. But she was clearly one of sort of Chernofsky's, you know, favorites. When I asked her how long she was on set, she said she worked at the cafeteria since 1949, so for 3 years. In reality, she had been on the set for 4 months, and she invited me and the photographer over for dinner at her apartment. Her apartment was, of course, part of the set. The dinner was probably one of the most surreal experiences I've had. Everyone was trying to keep a period appropriate conversation. Ole was the one who held her facade the best. Everyone else, including Chernofsky, kept slipping into anachronistic speech, and there was just no breaking her character. I sort of pulled her aside, and she pulled out her cigarette and had a smoke. The cigarette I checked was, of course, a period-appropriate Soviet cigarette. And I asked her if she wants to be an actress, if, you know, when she grows up, and she would have none of it. Said, no, why? I want to be a scientist. And she was just sort of perfect. And at some point, she pulled me aside and showed me her room. A little bedroom with a half-dead cactus and a nightgown thrown over the bed. It just felt like a pet showing off her cage. There was this atonal cello music being piped in everywhere the whole night through these pole-mounted speakers. I noticed that it was clearly audible in the room, and I asked her if it annoys her, and she said, no, I love it. Sometimes I sleep with the window open. It was a strange, disturbing, and somewhat erotic moment. She asked me to come back and see her tomorrow alone. And when a pretty girl asks you to come see her alone, you consider it for a second. But I realized that as irresistible as I may think I am, she was clearly acting on Chernofsky's orders to see if I can be quite literally seduced into staying on set. The idea of a camera in the ceiling was probably, you know, the best cold shower you could imagine. That night I was incredibly exhausted. The set really did suck the life out of you. And I got out with some measure of relief. And I was grateful to be out, but also really wanted to go back in.
Why would you want to go back?
Because it was in its own strange way beautiful, because it was a mystery, because it was a hell of a story.
And so the next morning, Michael donned his itchy trousers, walked down the narrow passageway, and entered the main square one last time.
That's when Chernofsky found me and stopped me, because it turns out that his conflict with Sergei, the photographer, had reached full boil. Sergei was trying to shoot Olya, the cafeteria worker, taking a bath. And that alone was fine with Chernofsky. But then the photographer asked her to put her hair up in a kind of a turban using a towel. And that really threw Chernofsky into a rage. Olya does not bathe in a turban. because of course he would know how she bathes. He would know how everyone bathes on the set. And I remember Hrzanowski just yelling, your photographer is asking people to pose, he's not observing life, he's staging it, and I can't have that, my people are not puppets. The last sentence was especially ironic because of course they were, but his puppets, not Sergei's. And Hrzanowski took kind of a dramatic breath and, you know, switched to this half whisper and said, we're ending our collaboration, you must leave. That's when I think my acculturation to the Soviet society reached its peak, because I realized what I had to do. I had to disown my own photographer. That's, of course, something that generations upon generations of Soviet people were forced to do, to betray those next to them in order to save their own hides. And that's what I did. I said, I understand, I agree completely. I've only just met this guy the GQ sent to photograph the story. He's not a friend of mine. If you feel that he's violating the rules... and even as I was hearing myself say these words, there's no need for the photographer even. I was aware of how fully I had succumbed to this fascist reality. And then I look at Hrzanowski and I see that he has a smile on his face, because he understands that this also was a bit of a performance, because I knew it would look great on the article to say that I've been conditioned. So I've helped him to create this self-portrait of a tyrannical genius, and he finally managed to completely control me. And I'm not sure if I'm proud of this story. I love it. It's the best magazine story I've ever written. But I'm not sure I'm proud of it.
And as for Hrzanowski and his toy?
At some point I asked Hrzanowski what would happen to the set after he was done with it. And he grew very pensive and said, I don't know. He had achieved the ultimate filmmaker's dream. He had become a creator and sole ruler of an entire tiny world. And once you experience that, it's very hard to let go.
All told, Hrzanowski would go on to shoot over 700 hours of film. When he was finally forced to wrap principal photography, Olya and all the other cafeteria workers, barbers and guards, shuttered their apartments, handed back their clothes, and returned to the real world. But not before Hrzanowski had them burn the set to the ground. That was 3 years ago. No one knows when the film will be released.
Michael Idov is now a novelist and a screenwriter living in New York and Moscow. His first Russian TV series, Leningrad, is filming in the UK and will premiere next spring. For more information about Michael's experience on the set of Dow, check out our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Joe Rosenberg and sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now then, when Snap Judgment returns, we're going to meet a miracle worker, and we're going to flirt with one of the greatest masters of all time, for real. And Snap Judgment, Behind the Curtain episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Snap, the Behind the Curtain episode. Today on the show, we're going backstage to find out who's pulling the levers. And since he was a kid, our next guest, Tahir Shah, has had an obsession with magic. His uncles from India would visit him in England and show him tricks and illusions. Young Tahir was transfixed.
I vowed that when I was older, one day, long, long in the future, I would go to India and I would learn magic for myself. It's kind of a crazy story. What happened was, when I was in my early 20s, I didn't think about it very much. I just did it. I got a one-way ticket from Britain, and I arrived in Calcutta, and I went in search of this Hakim Feroz, the greatest illusionist and stage magician in Indian history, really. I had no contact details for this guy. I didn't have a cell phone number. I didn't have anything. I just had his name. Just by an incredible coincidence, I bumped into him in a cafe in Calcutta. The first thing that struck me was everything about him was immaculate. His hair was oyster grey like his moustache, perfectly sculpted back with lavender-smelling brilliantine. A tweed jacket despite the heat, and in the little pocket of the waistcoat, the left side, a silver pocket watch. After a lot of cajoling, he agreed to take me on as a pupil. Hakim Feroz said to me, if I become his pupil, I have to do everything exactly as he says, as he ordered me. And if I refuse to do something, I would be thrown out on my ear immediately. So I decided right there and then I would do anything he wanted. So the great magician, Hakim Feroz, said that I had to come and live in his mansion on the outskirts of Calcutta in a very beautiful suburb called Alipur, where the very, very most beautiful houses were built. From the street, you couldn't really get a sense of what was behind the wall. But as I came in the first day, it was rather like Hakim Feroz himself. It was immaculate. It had an exquisite veranda on the back. And in the central courtyard, there were frangipani trees with this incredibly intoxicating scent. As I was walking through the gate up to the villa, I was absolutely terrified out of my mind. Really, from the outset of arriving, there was no moment that Feroz shook me by the hand and said, welcome, and we're going to learn illusions. Hakim Feroz subjected me to a horrific catalogue of almost debauched tests at trials and tribulations. The very first one was to dig a hole using a dessert spoon. The hole had to be 2 feet square and 2 feet deep. And I realized, okay, he's taking this seriously. So I will take it seriously because I don't want him to have a reason to kick me out. I started digging the soil, which was kind of sandy soil in this courtyard. And I had to put each dessert spoon into a bucket. I had to do it with my left hand, as I remember, which was really difficult at first. And I was sweating and sweating and sweating. I spent digging holes, I spent, I think, 3 or 4 days. But then there were all kinds of others. I had to jog backwards in laps around the courtyard, carrying a gigantically cold and heavy block of ice. The worst of all, the one that drove me absolutely mad, was to stand in the courtyard with my arms outstretched, hour after hour, with it was like 10 grains of rice on my left hand and a peeled grape on my right hand. And I had to hold them outstretched like a scale. He delighted in the fact that I was almost in tears. I did think about quitting like 1,000 times. And I would look at myself from a great height. And I would think, what the hell are you doing? Something in me said, give up, give up. But then another part of me kept saying, no, endure it a little longer. I learnt a bizarre catalogue of tricks, from how to eat glass, to how to stop my pulse, how to make the rain stop, or how to make the rain start, all kinds of illusions. You can take a bite of a glass light bulb, and you can chew it up without really getting any bleeding of your gums or your tongue or anything. But the secret is if you eat a banana beforehand, the glass, the tiny fragments of glass, will go down into your stomach and they'll get embedded in the banana and will just go through your intestines normally. I was beginning to think I was making good progress. I had learnt to put up with Feroz and I had learnt some of the basics of magic. With Feroz, he hated it if you were getting comfortable. So he could see I was getting quite used to being at his villa. Before I went to bed one night, Feroz said to me, "You're to go on a journey of observation, a journey around India. You have to leave." And I said, "When?" And he said, "At dawn." I was deeply upset. I thought, well, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? He said the journey could last a day, a week, a year, the rest of my life. Suddenly something hit me, and I thought to myself, instead of doing some pathetic, weak little journey, go on a grand adventure around India, the greatest journey of observation ever done. My obsession at the time was about godmen, Indian godmen. A godman is as close as India has to what a snake oil salesman must have been in the Wild West. He was part healer, part entertainer, part magician. And they go from village to village doing magic tricks. Okay, some of them do use it as a huge kind of medium for deception. And some of them are multi-millionaires. And Hakim Feroz, he frowned at the misuse of illusion as a medium, a matrix to deceive people. He didn't approve of that at all. I was taken by a rickshaw waller, you know, one of these guys running with a kind of rickshaw, hand rickshaw cart, to the Howrah train station, the old train station. I was on the platform waiting for the train to turn up. A few hours in, I saw a street boy called Balu, and he had a kind of, you know, it was a kind of routine that he was doing, you know, tricks and different things. And I kind of knew at that moment that we'd be great friends. He liked to be called the trickster. He could do amazing magic tricks. Yes, he could also pick pockets like I've never seen anyone do. Or he could seduce women far older than him because he was only 12. But he was charming, and I never really expected him to come with me on my journey or even leave Calcutta with me. But he said that he was coming too. I think at the time I kept brushing him off and cursing him, thinking he was going to rob me. But secretly, deep down, I was electrified, delighted that I'd have such a wise and charismatic young man with me. I traveled around with him on this zigzag trip around India. We passed through Orissa, which is a very, very, very poor state in India. And there had been a drought. And we heard that in a village not too far away, a witch had been caught. I said to Balu, let's go and see. So we went there. It was a few villages away. And it was a hot, really hot afternoon, baking afternoon. And as we approached the village where she was from, we saw a terrible drought. We saw a lot of dead animals and, you know, dead cows. We got to a village and the headman said, yes, yes, we've caught a witch and she's evil and we have locked her up. And I said, we've come from far away. And after quite a lot of cajoling, we were taken to where the witch was. And she had been locked in a kind of in a shed, in a shack. And they pulled her out and it was blinding sunlight in the afternoon. And she was blinking and she was frightened, so frightened. Poor, poor woman. And she was an old, old woman. I was very, very moved, but also incredibly upset because I could see that there is someone in front of me here on the ground with people ready to kick her face in again. I knew I had to get involved. I said that we had been sent to adjudicate and get to the bottom of the story. I showed my driving license, my British driving license. I pulled it out and I said, this was my document. And I said, what did she do? And she had been accused of a number of things. So, for example, she had made the water in the water tower go poisonous, turn poison. And we investigated and it turned out that there were two or three dead rats in there. And that had poisoned the water tower. And we fished them out, or Balu fished them out very bravely. It's very difficult for us sitting here in our nice clean clothes. We ate a nice breakfast, ate a nice lunch today, whatever. If you can picture an Indian village, a few adobe houses, drought, terrible drought, thirst, terrible, shocking thirst. There's this fear, and you see it in everyone's eyes. You see it on their lips even, because everyone's kind of wrinkled because they haven't drunk enough water. A hysteria, because someone has been caught, the witch, who all their problems in the village have been leveled on. There was no chance of ever explaining. This is not the way to get someone off the hook. And when we were walking through the village, Balu and I was very, very concerned. And I said, look, this is a serious situation. This woman could lose her life. And he said to me, let's do it from the inside out. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, if they want magic, we will give them magic. And I said to everyone, you know, crowded around, if I can do something mesmerizing and inexplicable to you, will you let this woman go? And eventually they said, all right, if you do real magic for us, then we will let her go. What would Feroz have thought about me using magic, passing myself off as a godman, to have an effect? I had a chance to save, you know, maybe save someone's life. So do I save their life? You better try to save their life, you know? And then I said, well, I can levitate. Hakim Feroz had taught me how to levitate in the way that a lot of godmen do. And it's very, very simple. And if I tell you the trick, you'll say, well, that's not real levitation. I asked Balu to get us a blanket. And he also got me a couple of bamboo rods. He diverted their attention for a few minutes. And when they came back, he brought them back to where I was. I was lying under the blanket with my head back, tilted back, almost like I was trying to float in a swimming pool. And under the blanket, I had these two bamboo rods. Very, very slowly, I lifted the rods under the blanket, arched my body, my torso upwards, and threw my head back. And it might not seem very convincing on radio, but I can bet you it looks damn convincing. After a few seconds, I came down again. And then I actually did a couple of other tricks. I burnt a fire on my tongue, which is camphor, which I had some with me. The villagers brought out some very rotten eggs. What I did was I managed to change. I mean, it's what every stage magician has done, you know, since time immemorial. I managed to change the line of sight. So I had an egg in my hand, and all of a sudden I got everyone to look for a fraction of a second somewhere else. And I opened my hand and the egg wasn't there because the egg was down my back, crushed and slippery. And then they were a bit irritated because they could see that they had lost their witch. So we left the village in the late afternoon, the three of us, Balu, the old lady and I, and we walked, you know, down a track towards the horizon. It was almost like a Western movie. And we walked two or three villages along the track and deposited the witch, the supposed witch, the old lady, at her relative's house. And Balu and I went on our way. I just remembered the coolness of the air. You know, it takes quite a long time for the air to really cool down. And you can breathe. It feels as if, you know, almost that you can breathe for the first time in your life. And it's the most delicious feeling alive.
Tahir Shah wrote a book about his journey through India. It's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and snappers, trust me, it is an amazing, magical, stupendous read. I loved it. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Leon Morimoto. just a moment. Snap Judgment returns with a story of misconnections you have got to hear to believe it's all true. And we continue the Behind the Curtain episode. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from WNYC, the Behind the Curtain episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and Silvana DeFaria, she thought she had it all until one fateful day when a conversation with a stranger changed everything. Snap Judgment.
It was the fall of 1990, Paris, France. A huge storm was raging, and Silvana, who lived on the outskirts of the city, rushed to get to Charles de Gaulle Airport in time. Her parents were flying in from Brazil, and she didn't want to, as usual, be late. When she finally gets there, the airport is packed with stranded people.
I looked for a place to sit, and I found an empty chair, and I sat, and I saw this man. I just said bonjour, and he smiled. And I remember I looked to him, to his teeth, because I'm obsessed with teeth. I thought, wow, he has wonderful teeth. He has manicured nails. He must love himself. And I love people who love themselves. He looked like a gentleman, that's it. He looked like a gentleman.
The man was a mature gentleman, probably in his early 60s. And he was staring at Silvana.
And I look at him and say, why are you staring at me? Oh, I'm not. I say, you are. And I thought, oh, Silvana, stop. And he said, no, I'm just, where are you from? The first thing he asked me. And I said, and you, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Colombia. Wow, you are neighbors. I'm from Brazil. What are you doing in Paris? And he said, oh, I'm a journalist. And you? So I didn't want to tell I was an actress. So at the beginning, I started to say, oh, I'm here to wait for my parents. I noticed he was staring at me. I didn't like it at the beginning. I just said, why he's staring at me? He was paying attention to me in a certain way. At the first second, I didn't feel comfortable. He was looking to my shoes, my legs, my hands. I just told him, look, I'm not a prostitute. He said, why are you saying that? I didn't say you were. I tell you something. As soon as you say you are Brazilian, they think you are a travesti, they think you are a prostitute. And he said, I didn't think that at all. And I said, yeah, I think you did because I can read your thoughts. And he started to laugh. And then I felt more comfortable.
The man asked Silvana if she's seen any good films lately. Actually, she just watched one based on a story by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. She was the only person in the movie theater.
It's absolutely horrible, the film. And he looked at me and said, why did you not like? I said, I hate it. I didn't read the book. I said, I didn't read the novel. But, you know, it's very hard to do adaptation from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So the guy must be a genius to have a film done by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And he was looking at me, you know, and I'm talking about details about the film, about what I like, what I didn't like.
She noticed the man kind of taken aback by her comments, but his interest in her only seemed to grow.
I opened my bag and I said, look, it's my pill time now. Do you want to take a pill? He said, no, what is this about? And I said, look, I had a car accident, in the beginning of the year.
It was a near-fatal accident, she told him. For months, she couldn't step inside a car out of fear, and then ended up in a therapist's office. Turning to the stranger, she pointed to each little tablet in her pillbox.
This one is to sleep. This one is to wake up. This one is to have a poo. This one is to not have a poo. This one is to make love. This one is to not make love. This one is to not miss Brazil. This one is when I want to miss Brazil. I have a pill for everything. And he was laughing. He was nearly in tears. So they think I'm crazy. And he said, no, I don't think you are crazy. No. Carry on. Why do you take pills? And I said, because I love them. And I told him, look, I have so many stories that you can write a book. And he laughed too.
Silvana told him that when she was 22, she bought a one-way ticket to Paris, her dream to become a history professor. But it got too expensive to study, so she took to modeling and acting.
I just say the truth. I say, look, I am living a dream, but I am just the girl who came from the Amazon and I'm here. It was quite a loss of identity. He said, are you happy here? And I didn't know. And I said, look, the only way to stay in this country is if you are in love. And he said, with France? And I said, no, of course not only France. With a man, of course a man. I fell in love at first sight. And this is the only reason I stay in Paris. It's the only way, because sometimes it's hard.
She told him about her passionate yet turbulent relationship with her fiancé, this French film director. He recently gave her a parrot named Antoine, you know, so she wouldn't miss Brazil so much.
I started to laugh and say, can you believe a parrot in a cage? But of course, I never leave the parrot in a cage. I open the cage so he everywhere, making my partner crazy because the parrot goes and starts to bite the furniture. And during the night, my partner arrives, he puts it on the cage. And I have a few friends I kept from when I was a student. And when they visit me, especially one of them says, Silvana, you see Antoine, the parrot, is you inside the cage. We live like in a golden cage. And I told him that, I think I nearly cried. And he said, you were sad. I said, no, I'm not sad. How can I be sad? I'm very happy. I tried my best to show him I was happy, but I was not. I was very emotional and I was really thinking about what I was saying. And then I felt him very close to me. It's like we forgot time, we forgot the place where we were. It was very intense. But there was a moment I felt curious, so why he wants to know about me? So what he wants from me? I'm no one, I am nobody. But I looked at him and I said, it is funny. I have a feeling I know this man. It was me now who started to stare on him. He was embarrassed. He said, why are you looking? And I look and I say, I know you. Shh, quiet. What are you screaming? What are you talking about? You are Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I stand up to leave. And he stopped me. He said, Where are you going? I said, I'm leaving you. And he said, why? Because you lied to me. He said, no, I didn't lie. You didn't tell me who you were, and I know you are, because my mom gave me Love in the Times of Cholera. And there was a picture of you in the back. It's you! I felt betrayed. I felt, why he didn't tell me it was him? I spent my whole day talking to him. He asked me 100 questions. I was angry. And it's crazy, but that moment happened that my parents were coming. I saw my mom and he held me. He was literally holding my arm. And I didn't know what to do. And I said, goodbye. He looked straight away into my eyes. He looked at me, he said, for you, I'm Gabo. And he wrote down his name and his address. You lied to me How can I be sure this is your address? Maybe it's a fake address. Please write me. I want you to write me, please. So I look at him and said, only if you write me a story. And then I said, no, I cannot take a piece of him like that. He's Gabriel Garcia Marquez, for God's sake. And he told me, yes, I will. And I said, I have to go. I wanted to go. I want to disappear. So I walked towards my parents. And I was near the gate. I heard him. He came towards me again. And he said, I don't know your name. You are never going to know my name. Did you tell me yours? When I read that Gabriel Garcia Marquez passed away, the first reaction I had was tears because I felt so sad.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Nobel Prize-winning author, passed away recently. He was 87. Silvana, now a grandmother living in London, still holds on to the piece of paper with his address and phone number.
I never call him. Why? Why never call him? I think I had intention, but something stopped me. I think I was scared to call him.
Silvana started poking around the internet to see if she could find a photo of him from that time long ago.
And what I found was the story, the novel, Sleeping Beauty at the Plane. I was curious and I printed and I read in French, English, Portuguese. And I couldn't believe.
She was dressed with subtle taste. A lynx jacket, a raw silk blouse with delicate flowers, natural linen trousers, and shoes with a narrow stripe the color of bougainvillea.
He described her wearing a silk top and a leather jacket. He described exactly the clothes I was wearing. It's too much coincidence.
She placed a cosmetics case with copper corners, like a grandmother's trunk, on her lap, and took two golden pills from a box that contained others of various colors.
So I go further. I read. And he talks about love at first sight.
By way of an excuse, I asked her if she believed in love at first sight. Of course, she said. The other kinds are impossible.
It was like a flashback. And little by little, I was very moved. I just felt like he was just next to me. It's very odd. I just felt him talking.
But it's fiction. Marquez changes the story. He and the beautiful woman never exchange a word. They simply sit next to each other on a red eye to New York. She sleeps the whole way and he sits by, willing her to wake up so they can talk. When she finally does, it's too late. The plane has landed.
Then she put on her lynx jacket. Almost stepped over me with a conventional excuse in pure Latin American Spanish, left without even saying goodbye, and disappeared into the sun of today
in the Amazon jungle of New York. I was lost. I just cried.
Thank you, Silvana, for sharing your story. For more details about that day and everything else Silvana and Marquez chatted about, check out Nicholas Shakespeare's Newsweek article from our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Nancy Lopez with sound design by Pat Massini Miller. Don't be sad. Full episodes of Snap are available for you right now. Subscribe to the podcast. SnapJudgment.org, Facebook, on Twitter, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Android, get it your way. Snap was produced by the finest team of artists ever to order a double monster heavy on the heavy cheeseburger. Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat Massini Miller,
Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Renzo Gorio, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Davey Kim, Leon Morimoto, Aurora Soria, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, and Jasmine Aguilera. Did you ever play that game, spin the bottle with a bunch of super attractive people? Well, not to fear. Neither did the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but much love to the CPB. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could go backstage at the Prince concert, have the purple one sing Diary Nikki just for you, accidentally say, thanks, Rick James, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.